I'm Jim Benson, and you're listening to TV Time Machine on Intelligent Talk, 1170 KCBQ, and archived on TVTimeMachine.com.
Teddy told me that in Greek, nostalgia literally means the pain from an old wound. It's a twinge in your heart. Far more powerful than memory alone. This device isn't a spaceship. It's a time machine. It goes backwards and forwards. It takes us to a place where we ache to go again.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're about to embark on a journey through a vast galaxy that traverses memory, generations, and popular culture. A magical trip through time as we meet the men and women of yesterday and today who have shaped not only what we see on TV, but the way we see ourselves. I'm Jim Benson. Join me, if you will, on an exploration of television's past, present, and future as we climb aboard the TV Time Machine. Our destination subject today will be the era of the 1960s and the extraordinary Emmy Award-winning television series Mad Men. Creator and executive producer on the series, Matthew Weiner, will join me and co-host Lisa Rothstein as we explore the fascinating story behind this modern-day TV classic. We'll begin our exciting and fun-filled odyssey right after these brief messages.
I was born Mary Tyler Moore.
Is Jesse Donald Knotts?
Fred McFeely Rogers.
Leslie Moonves.
Isabel Sanford.
Leslie Renee Stahl.
Robert Edward Turner.
Regis Francis Philbin.
Aaron Spelling.
Since 1999, the Archive of American Television has been preserving the memories, knowledge, and insights of the men and women whose talents and vision have helped shape this remarkable medium. Over 500 video interviews with these TV legends are now available on the Archive of American Television website at metvlegends.org. There, you can sign up to receive news, updates, and also become a sponsor to help preserve television history for generations to come. That's metvlegends.org.
The mythological proportions of Star Trek provide something that's missing in people's consciousness, psyche.
The Archive of American Television, capturing television history, one voice at a time. Today on the TV Time Machine, we travel back to the 1960s by way of 2012, to a time and place replete with ambition, duplicity, creativity, and especially smoke-filled conference rooms such as the world of Mad Men. In this very special edition of our program, we are proud to welcome Emmy Award-winning creator and executive producer of Mad Men, Matthew Weiner. Mr. Weiner's career also includes executive producer on The Sopranos and also producing Becker, and Andy Richter controls the universe. Over the next few segments, we will honor this extraordinary series as I'm joined by co-host Lisa Rothstein, whose own Madison Avenue career has included positions as copywriter and creative director for Young and Rubicam and Ogilvy and Mather. Again, for those of you intrepid enough to join us for this high-pressure show, feel free to sail past the close as we slip from the restraints of the present and into a new and improved past. Matt, thank you for coming on board the TV Time Machine.
I'm glad to be here.
Say hi to Lisa.
Hi, I'm here.
Matt, we're going to go back to the very beginning. Where were you born, and what was life like for you growing up as a young lad?
I was born in Baltimore, Maryland, and lived there till I was 11. And then we moved. My dad's an academic physician, and we moved to Los Angeles, where he worked at USC. He still works there as a neuroscientist. And growing up, I don't know what to tell you. I'm third of four children. I'm the oldest boy. I was a dreamy, undisciplined child. Not much of a student, But I had the advantages because of the academic focus of our family of having a very, very good education, despite my my instincts to underperform.
Well, your early days in television were spent writing for comedy shows mainly. As a young man, were you a cut-up or a class clown when you were growing up?
I was a bit of a class clown. I was a bit of a class clown, and actually my introduction into television itself was made because I was voted in my high school class to give a speech at graduation, and I had given some speeches running for president. I'd been class president 1 year, and people knew that I was funny. I had done a lot of theater and what passed for stand-up in our talent areas, and I gave this speech at graduation, which with the title of it was being the salutatorian, which is usually the second in the class, but I was actually voted to tell jokes. and I did. And afterwards, a classmate of mine's father happened to be, this is in Los Angeles, happened to be Alan Burns, who is one of the creators of the Mary Tyler Moore Show and the Munsters and Lou Grant. And Alan came up to me afterwards and said, "You should think about writing for TV. You're very funny. You did every kind of joke you could do there." And he sort of kept track of me while I was in college.
Wow.
And even though I was interested in writing poetry, I as soon as I graduated, I went to film school, and he sort of kept track of me and helped me get a job, actually, between college and film school. I was waiting to get in, and that was my whole thing. He gave me some scripts and took me to the studio, and after that, we weren't really involved career-wise, but that's how I even knew such a job existed. And a friend of mine got a TV show after making an independent film and brought me in to tell jokes when they were, it's called Punch Up. And I went into the room, and they hired me. I had no script. I've been writing very depressing movies. And,
depressing because they were depressing, or because they, you know, you weren't particularly proud of them?
No, I think they're high-quality movies. Yeah. I just think that when you are, I graduated from film school. I had made a very funny documentary, but my wife was supporting us while I wrote for 3 years, and I think when you're alone writing like that, that's what you do. And also drama has a different sort of lure to it. You don't really has a different allure. And I think when you're in that situation, that was the style, and that's what I was interested in doing. So, but once I came in and told jokes on the show, I was in that world and got a series of jobs. First, just telling jokes, then I became a script draft writer because people saw that I could write. And then I became a story person, and while I was at Becker, I realized that it was not necessarily what I wanted to keep doing, and comedy was drying up anyway. There was really less and less good half-hour comedy on TV, and it's just a market decision or something. But anyway, I wrote the script basically because I was frustrated and because it had always been a passion and interest of mine. I saw it as very comic. But anyway, I eventually got them 2 years after I wrote it to send it to David Chase, and I got a job on The Sopranos. It was my writing sample, the pilot of the show.
Wow. What did your family, since your father is an academic and a neuroscientist, and I think your mom is in law?
My mother is an attorney. My mom went back to law school in the early 70s, and then we moved to California, and she passed the bar and worked for a judge, and then she stopped working. But what do they think about my career?
Well, I mean, I'm sure they're very proud now, but at the beginning.
So you know what? Honestly, I have to say, I'm hard on them a lot of times because I use my life and whatever unique upbringing I have. I mean, a lot of the way that the conversation works in the show is sort of the way we talk in my family. It's very bleak.
Yeah.
They were extremely supportive of this, especially once I went to graduate school. Anyone who's Chinese American or Jewish American knows that going to graduate school will really shut your parents up for a long time. So once I was in grad school, but even before that, they always knew that I was an artist, and there's a lot of value on writers. There always was. My parents are big readers, and I think it's part of the story of this era. They got married in 1959, but their heroes are people like Ernest Hemingway, and we had a big poster of Ernest Hemingway in our house, and they're big, big readers. We were expected to know who all these people were and to respect writers and to look at that as an important part of the culture. And, my oldest sister became a physician. My other sister became an attorney. My little brother is a doctor, but they were very, very encouraging of me pursuing this. I think that they preferred it because they knew that the other option was that I might become an actor, and I think that was very hard on them. That was it. As a parent, they really didn't want me to spend my life doing that, or not doing that, not succeeding.
Well, with such a serious literary pedigree, how did you feel writing? I mean, I love sitcoms, but how did you feel writing for sitcoms when that is, I understand, pretty much sitting around telling jokes with
you know what? I loved it. I felt I'm a history person, and I felt part of a tremendous tradition, and I got to work with some people who had done. You know, it was a golden era of sitcoms. I wasn't allowed to watch TV as a kid, except for on the weekends. We weren't allowed to watch on school nights.
Wow.
So I was part of the Brady Bunch, Partridge Family era. That was the only TV I was allowed to watch. And then when things like Happy Days and MASH came on, they were on during the week, so I never saw those. But what was really, you know, but you can imagine Mary Tyler Moore, All in the Family, those were all on Saturday night, and Bob Newhart. And I consider myself, I got to work with people who wrote on those shows, and I actually wow. have tremendous respect for it and awe. And to sit in a room with David Isaacs and Ken Levine, who wrote 40 episodes of MASH and 30 episodes of Cheers, Bob Ellison, who wrote for Jackie Gleason and Frank Sinatra and Taxi and Mary Tyler Moore, this was a tradition that I was really excited to be a part of. So the show that I was actually on at the time that sort of drove me away from it was really, I think sitcom in general always has this bifurcated, you know, environment between what is, Seinfeld was on the air while I was working. You just can't get a higher art form than that in terms of big situation comedy. And Roseanne had been on right before that. So there were things to aspire to, but it was not what was going on when I was there. I think that besides Frasier and Raymond, there really wasn't, Friends was winding down, there really wasn't anything particularly, I was not part of any of those shows, and mm-hmm. So I was frustrated at what the world was offering me at that point. And there is a very sort of pat, it's hard to tell, you know, it's market-driven, as I said, but the people who were in charge of the shows at that time and the shows that were on were not exciting to me. But other than, I was like everybody else, I was watching The Law and Orders, which I love, you know, the procedurals and, you know, ER, but the rest of it was just not interesting to me.
Well, The Sopranos must have been very interesting to
when
you
Sopranos,
then.
I wrote the pilot right when Sopranos was coming on the air, and when I saw that was just blew my mind. And I didn't, I don't know if I've really said this, I wasn't crazy about the pilot because I'm not a big fan of torture or violence for the purposes of humor, and that's what I thought the show was. And my wife was into it right away, and by the time episode 5 came on, which is the college episode where Tony takes his daughter to college, she said to me, she literally pushed me on the shoulders and said, you have to watch this, sat me down on the couch. And after I saw that, I turned to her and I was like, do you know what they're doing here? And she's like, that's why you wanted you to watch it. And it just made me feel less alone. Its commercial success was very encouraging, that it was so good and so complex and so related to our lives and was, you know, had a huge audience and was making money. That was just something where I was like, well, this is very heartening.
Well, I have a small personal story. I was excited to see the success of The Sopranos 2 because I actually dated James Gandolfini about 15 years ago when he was a bartender around the corner from my apartment in New York. And so all you actors out there who are listening, it's possible. It was like it was 1992. And the funny thing is that he was doing Tony Soprano from behind the bar as a kind of a joke, you know, like imitating his, hey, you, hey, Guido, hey, Vinny, hey.
Right.
You know, and I was going to see him in these very obscure little off Broadway plays that were sort of like Chekhov with like three people in the audience, and he was very serious, very, very serious actor even then. But the funny thing is that what made him famous was the was something that he would laugh now.
What? He brought so much to that part. He's a gifted actor, and he takes things so seriously, and it was really a joy to work with him and see him in that. And when that he was just a very different person than that. It was stunning to me. You know, Michael Imperioli also, you know, sitting in the writer's room with Michael Imperioli, and the first time he started using big words, I was like, oh my God, he's not Christopher. Well, and really smart.
Jim was serious even when there weren't 80 million people watching him. He was just as serious when there were three people watching him. So.
Yeah, oh, no.
I'm not surprised that he succeeded as an actor.
I bet. No, I always have said that, you know, his physique and everything, he's one of those people who's not disappointing when you meet him because he is really, really big and really imposing. But there is a very artsy thespian inside that person. And I've seen him, you know, we did this episode this where he was in a parallel universe and he played this salesman. And he came into the room and did the character the way he was going to do it. This is Kevin Finnerty. After he was shot, I just watched him, and I was like, this man can do anything.
Excuse me. Is this the Finnerty reunion?
Hello there. They're waiting for you.
Me?
Of course.
Has Kevin Finnerty arrived?
We don't talk like that here.
Whoa. What do you mean?
Your family's in sight.
What family?
They're here to welcome you.
I don't understand.
You're going home.
I am?
It's funny because, I mean, you knew him in the world. I never got to know him in the world. I joined the show season 5, and I had a lot of preconceptions about who he was.
Well, it's so funny because girlfriends of mine who knew that, I mean, a lot of the women in the neighborhood knew him because he was a very charming bartender. And
right.
When my friends found out, you're going out with Jimmy Gandolfini, I would never go out with him. He's crazy. He's weird. And it's true. He would joke around, and you wouldn't know that he was really joking. And there was that sort of kind of double-edged sort of, is he kidding, or is he really, did he really mean that? That I kind of dug, so, you know.
Oh, if I was your husband, I wouldn't want to have to compete with that, I have to tell you.
I feel no threat whatsoever.
As it is, my wife, whenever she sees a picture of me and John Hamm next to each other, she always says, is he standing on something? I said, no, he's just that much taller.
Now, John Hamm, I might feel a little bit of a threat, but...
Yeah. I don't know. Women love Jim just as much.
Matt, was there a singular specific event or inspiration that you tapped into that led to the creation of Mad Men?
You know, I have to say, I've thought about this a lot, and there really isn't. It's an idea that was just some sort of inkling. And the more research I did and the different parts of my life sort of coincided, and it just snowballed into a fully formed idea. And because it's something now that it's there, it looks like a genre and an idea that is a commercially viable concept. But it was literally the same creative process that anybody goes through with a new idea, which was winnowing out bad things. You know, I worked in television, which is very similar to advertising. Doing any research about the period, advertising comes up all the time. There are a few movies. This was a genre, this boardroom thing. I talked about Patterns, the Rod Serling Playhouse 90. I saw the movie version of it when I was very young. Executive Suite, mm-hmm. Cash McCall, which was written by the same person, Cameron Hawley, who wrote Executive Suite. And those were the things that I was interested in, which is, you know, we're functioning in these institutions, but we're still individuals being brought there from wherever we go, whether we're the children of immigrants or in the process of assimilation or in the process of being greedy or getting rich and then wondering if we've changed. Those issues, you know, how romance fits into that, what's the role of the woman behind the man is always a big part of the story, or even the woman with power. Executive Suite is all about, you know, and Patterns also, secretaries and loyal secretaries and the wife of the chairman of the board who has inherited the business. There's so much that I've taken from that.
We're going to have to take a little break, but we'll be back in a moment with creator and executive producer of Mad Men, Matthew Weiner, right here on the TV Time Machine.